Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. On July 27th, 1827, the Dey of Algiers struck the French consul general with a fan over his country's refusal to pay back its debts, specifically to two Jewish merchant families, the Bakri and the Buznaks. It may have been an error of judgment. France blockaded Algiers soon after and later invaded, turning Algeria into a French colony. But the unpaid debt had festered as an issue for almost 30 years. Foreign consuls in the corsairian capital of Algiers sent missives back to their superiors complaining about the Bakri and the Buznaks and the doggedness they had in pursuing their debts. Julie Coleman writes about these two families and their interfamilial business dealings and squabbles in The Kings of Algiers, How Two Jewish Families Shaped the Mediterranean World During the Napoleonic Wars and Beyond, from Princeton University Press. Julie Coleman is Associate Professor of History at Monash University. She has published widely on the history of French Jewry in the 19th century and in the post-war period. She is also the author of Orientalizing the Jew, Religion, Culture, and Imperialism in 19th Century France, and Rethinking Antisemitism in 19th Century France. Today, Julie and I talk about the Bakri and the Buznaks, the strange relationship between Algiers, Britain, France, and the U.S., and what sanctions and debt diplomacy looked like in the early 19th century. Julie, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about the Kings of Algiers and the Bakri and Buznak families.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start by asking about Algiers and the Algerian corsairing system, because I think that's pretty important to figuring out kind of what place these families hold, I guess, in the international affairs of the time. So how did this corsairing system work?
I think it's best to understand corsairing as part of a kind of sanctioned, unofficial economic system in the Mediterranean, because everyone did it. So European powers, all those North African powers, the Pope had his own corsairs, and corsairing is not the same thing as piracy. So corsairs would traditionally go out kind of scouring the Mediterranean. They would attack ships flying flags of powers with whom they were at war. And this is a time of the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, so there's lots of that kind of thing going on. And this was about money-making. So they wouldn't kill everyone. They would take over the ship, they would tow it into harbour, and then sell everything off, all the cargo, and the passengers and crew could make them a lot of money through ransom. So it was important actually to keep people alive because they could be sources of income. The boat would also be sold. And this was such a good, basically a money spinner for the Regency of Algiers, that there were times when the ruler of Algiers, the Dey, would actually declare war in order to be able to attack the ships of one or other power. Or he would declare war, and then what would happen was that power would pay him off not to attack their ships. So either way, it was great income.
And I guess my question is like how did the powers of the time feel about this? It seems like, I mean, obviously they were annoyed about it, but at least at times they didn't seem that annoyed about it, and in fact may have been beneficial to them.
Exactly. By the time we get to the revolution, corsairing had been going for a few centuries. It had waned in the first half of the 18th century, but the revolution and the Napoleonic Wars bring chaos to the Mediterranean. And amidst that chaos, corsairing thrives again. But by the time we get to there, generally, particularly European powers, the British, the French, the Spaniards, the Italian states, are getting pretty sick of it because, in a sense, they've moved on in an economic way. They want to be able to rely on trade, and corsairing is a constant threat and an interruption to trade. So by the time we get to the early 19th century and the Napoleonic Wars, we find the European powers really now wanting to push back hard against this kind of trade. The Americans as well, because they're really trying to stake a claim in Mediterranean trade, and the last thing they want is for their ships to be constantly attacked.
So let's move on to these trading families, the Bakri and the Buznaks.
Yep.
Where did they come from? How did they get to Algiers?
We don't know where they came from. What we know about them is that in the late 16th century, in the 1590s, so we go to Italy now, one of the Medici counts, a member of the Medici family, decided that he would like to develop the port of Livorno, which is on the Tuscan coast of Italy, into a trading port. And in order to do that, he needed traders. So he invited Jews, Christians, and Muslims to come and settle there, and he guaranteed all of them religious freedom. You know, this is at a time when there's enormous hostility in those Catholic states towards Jews and Muslims. This is called the Livornina. So we know that members of the Bakri and Buznak families went to take advantage of this opportunity. We know that they then went to Algiers to take advantage of another business opportunity a couple of centuries later. What we don't know is whether these were Jews who were part of that big contingent expelled from the Iberian Peninsula, or whether they were what we think of or what we call Arab Jews, who actually settled in that part of the world when they came there with the Romans. And over centuries and centuries, they Arabized. We have no clue. So it's hard to say exactly what they were, what type of Jew, I guess, they were.
And they seem to have this great influence over the Dey of Algiers, who's constantly bringing up their woes to, and I guess, litigating their disputes over debt with foreign powers. Why did they have such influence over the ruler of Algiers?
Because they cut him in as their business partner, basically. Jews had a unique position in the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire is this empire that tolerates Jews and Christians. They're called people of the book. They are seen as slightly lesser religious communities than Muslims, but they're given kind of communal rights. And as far as the authorities were concerned, you couldn't trust Christians. You couldn't trust Christians in positions of power because they might then make deals with those Christian nations across the Mediterranean. You couldn't trust other Muslims in positions of power because they might try and usurp you. But you could trust Jews. You could trust Jews in positions of power because they weren't Muslims. They didn't have the kind of access to all sorts of positions and powers that Muslims had. And they didn't have a powerful state protecting them, like Christians potentially did. So there were ways in which Jews could access the elites, the rulers, and gain positions of power. And in Algiers, if someone like Naftali Buznak or Joseph Bakri was able to become head of the Jewish community there, then they had a direct line to the Dey. They could really develop a relationship with the Dey. And this is what members of the families did, so that they would bring the Dey into their business as their business partner. And this is how that they were then able to make matters of business become matters of diplomacy.
The Bakri seemed to care about one particular loan made to France, and I don't know the exact date, but kind of in the late 18th century.
Correct. Yeah.
And then they spend something like, what it feels like, 30 to 40 years constantly complaining about France's inability to pay back this debt. And obviously they're still like lending money to France, though, but people so they're still doing business, but this debt pops up again and again and again.
Yeah.
And France is continually saying it is not paying him back. Why was this particular, well, first, what was this particular loan, and why did it become so troublesome to France and Algiers and the Bakery? Like, why this loan?
Mm. Well, one of the things that's really the sort of the untold parts of all this history that underpins a lot of other things is food security.
Mm.
And, European powers didn't really find a way to resolve that question of food security until the late 19th century. So they spend a lot of time up until then worrying about harvests and where they're going to get enough wheat to feed the population. And this is exactly what happens in the revolution, where in the lead up to the revolution, you have a couple of bad harvests, and that particularly affects the south of France. So they desperately need wheat. And at this time, Algiers, which is pretty much contiguous with today's Algeria, is a major supplier of wheat. So the Bakris by this time have made a deal with the Dey. They have the monopoly over the wheat trade, and they agree to supply wheat to the revolutionary government on credit. Now, the revolutionary regime is fighting a war on all fronts. It has internal dissent that it's trying to quell. All the powers of Europe are at its doors because they've just beheaded the king, and no one else wants that to happen to them. So they have no money. So the Bakri say, okay, so we'll open a line of credit and we'll supply as much wheat to you as you need. And the French government takes them at their word and builds up a debt of about 7 million francs. And the Bakris then put a lot of energy into trying to recoup that money. And that is why they send the youngest brother, Jacob, to France. His job is to basically harass the French regime until they agree to repay that debt. So this becomes really central in the relationship between the Bakris and France.
So the Bakri keep on pushing for this debt repayment.
Yeah.
The Dey also sort of pushing for this debt repayment.
Yeah.
And so you have all these consuls in Algiers who are, I guess, complaining about the Bakri, complaining about the power they have. They feature a lot in diplomatic correspondence
all over the place. Yes.
So, you know, how did this family then become this kind of matter of international importance? Why did the consuls keep on writing about them?
Yeah. It's extraordinary. You know, I would say that arguably for about four decades, they're the best known Jews in the Mediterranean. You have Napoleon invites Jacob to dinner. He designates the family. He was a micromanager. It's extraordinary. I found in his correspondence one letter where he's actually scrawled a note in the margin, and it's, go find the Bakris, tell them I want them to supply my troops in Egypt, and here's what I need. And he's written a list. And being French, of course, the first thing on the list is wine. But Horatio Nelson was furious with them and prepared to park his whole fleet in front of the port, insisting that they be sent away from the Regency. The thing is, I think that all of these people misunderstood the nature of power relations in a place like the Regency. And the Bakris were able to get incredible access to the elite and to the ruling Dey. But at the same time, and this is a spoiler alert, I guess, two members of the Bakri family are murdered by the regime because of a perception that they've actually become too powerful. So there's great reward, but there's also great risk with that. But what Europeans, the only thing Europeans could see was that here were Jews who in their own country were this subjugated minority, exercising this incredible power and frustrating their ambitions. And I think you're right that they're everywhere in the diplomatic correspondence. And every place I looked, I found them. Because I think that it was easy, in a way, to blame everything on them. They certainly had some power. It's hard to know exactly how powerful they were because, of course, you know, we know that there could be terrible consequences. So their power wasn't limitless. But the book is really about a history of perceptions, and it's the fact that they were perceived to be so powerful. And I think part of that is just because for these consuls from Britain and France and Spain and the Italian states, Denmark, Sweden, the US, here were Jews behaving in ways that they had never seen Jews behave.
And, you know, let's dig into that a bit more. I mean, so it's, you know, how important is it that these families were Jewish? You know, both in terms of their status in Algiers, which I mean, there's certainly one point in the book which feels like I guess a turning point for the Bakri, which is when the Dey is murdered by one of his janissaries, and then the janissaries go on this basically this like murder and pillaging spree throughout, I guess, the Jewish communities of Algiers.
Yeah.
So I guess how important is it that these families were Jewish?
Right throughout the Ottoman Empire, you had Jewish and Christian minorities who competed for trade, and Armenian Christians, Greek Orthodox Christians, all sorts of those Eastern Christian branches. In Algiers, one of the things that's key is that there actually wasn't a Christian minority. So that space of minority and trading minority was solely occupied by the Jewish community, which probably made up about 10% of the population of the port of Algiers. As I said before, being Jewish gave them the chance to access, have a direct line to power in a way that Christians and Muslims might not have been able to. I think also the fact that they were Jewish meant that when you had these diplomats coming from places like France and England and all the other countries that I listed, there's a sense in which the Bakris and the Buznaks were a known quantity. They knew what Jews were. They'd gone to church every Sunday and been taught what Jews were, but they also, there were Jews where they lived. So the Bakris, in a way, were familiar in a way that the rest of the population of the regency wasn't to foreign consuls coming. And it's really fascinating through the book. What I find is while they're writing about how dreadful these Bakris are because they're so powerful and they're untrustworthy and pernicious and they're undermining our plans, at the same time they would be meeting one another in their homes. There was a sort of intimacy because at the same time they are nonetheless a kind of known quantity.
So I do want to kind of talk about how I guess quote unquote diplomacy is being used during this time, or perhaps kind of like what all these countries are doing to try to, you know, either get this debt paid back or trying to I guess the kind of the financial diplomacy of its Dey. Everyone's taken hostage all the time in both Algiers and in Europe.
Yeah.
Assets are seized and maybe it all seems very I'm going to use the word arbitrary and very personal, as in people are being taken hostage as a matter of, you know, a matter of ordinary diplomacy. You know, how did, you know, moves like, you know, sequestration work, and what do they tell us about how international relations of the time was conducted?
Yes. I think it's really interesting. It's a time of change. So sequestration, and I'm going to mispronounce this, but it was established as part of jus belli, so that the laws of war, that it was that any regime had the right to sequester. And it's a fundamental kind of, you've got something of mine that you're not giving back, and therefore I'm going to take something of yours that's of equal value, and take it and hold it hostage until you return to me what's mine. That's the fundamental principle, and it could involve people. So, in other words, when, for example, Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1798, and this was war, the Sultan declared war on France, then all French citizens were held in prison in Algiers. And in response, the French regime says, well, if you're holding our citizens, we're going to hold yours to make sure that you don't harm them, basically. So, it could also be that kind of idea of safekeeping. Not quite hostage diplomacy, but not far from it, I think. So the Bakris get wound up in this because they're seen again as so powerful that they somehow are deeply significant. And I have one of the things that I found was Napoleon sent his secret police to report in depth on members of the family and their wealth so that they could know when they wanted to sequester them exactly how much money they should hold, so that to make sure that they had everything that was owned by this person. So there was this idea that members of the family would had hoards of precious jewels that they would hide in the walls of their home, for example. Part of this story is a story of what we can think of as informal imperialism, where particularly France and Britain are trying to get some kind of advantage in the regency. They both want the wheat. They both want to have control over corsairing. They both want to have access to all the primary products that the regency is producing, so wool and wax as well, for example, and other grains. And because they're at war with one another, they also want to try and block the other. So they're not out and out colonizing, but they're nonetheless trying to exert some kind of influence. And one of the things that this history lets me do is something that historians are really keen on trying to uncover, which is how did imperialism work on the ground when there were two imperial forces in contest? What did that do to imperialism? And so we get that in Algiers, and we can use the Bakris as this sort of external perspective on the contest, particularly between the French and the British, and their sense of what they were able to achieve on the ground and how that shifted and adjusted their ambitions, and particularly how that then got translated back into the metropole in Paris and London.
So I want to talk about one member of this family, specifically Jacob. And it seems like there's an entire chapter of the book devoted to
Jacob's troubles,
Jacob's troubles and, how his fa how members of his family have really screwed him. By basically, I guess, siphoning off the money for themselves. The books are nowhere to be seen. So why does Jacob have such a hard time with the rest of his family when he's in Paris?
Well, one thing I should say is that the sources that this book is based on are mostly diplomatic correspondence, but the other part of this is Jacob's book of business correspondence that for some reason found its way into the departmental archives in Marseille in southern France. And there are about 500 letters from him when he was living in Marseille doing business, including his letters to his cousin and his brothers when things start to go very wrong. So Jacob's the youngest. The Bakris were a family of five brothers, they were linked to the Buznaks. Naftali Buznak was their nephew. And Naftali had a brother, Michel Buznak, the French version of Michael, who was a cad, basically, a real shyster. But Jacob himself, you know, you get the sense as the story goes on that Jacob wasn't the most reliable. And it's clear that his brothers certainly didn't trust him to do. I don't know why they sent him to France, but they very quickly came to feel grave doubts about his ability to do what he needed to do. So on the one hand, I get Jacob's perspective on this because the only surviving documents from this family are his correspondence. But on the other hand, it's true, and perhaps this is through no fault of his own, perhaps it's actually through poor judgment, that Jacob is defrauded by Naftali's brother Michel to the tune of several thousand, hundred thousands of francs. Jacob is in France doing business. He runs out of money. He goes to Livorno to his big brother Salomon, who is doing very well in Livorno, to ask him to bail him out. So clearly, you know, he's not the most astute, he's not the best of businessmen. Solomon does so reluctantly. But while Jacob is there being bailed out, he leaves the business in the hands of Michel Buznak, who then basically defrauds him. And Jacob doesn't begin to realise the extent of this or even that this is happening until he comes back to Marseille. And then when he goes to his brothers and begs them to sort this out, it's like they've had enough of him. They just refuse to do so. So at the centre of this whole kind of big story of the Mediterranean War is this wonderful history of this utterly dysfunctional family. Jacob gets his revenge in the end. A French court finds in his favour, by the way, but by that time he's given up and he's gone back to Algiers. And his older brother Joseph is now at the head of the Jewish community. He manages to undermine Joseph and to get him to get the day to exile him. And Joseph, who seems like he was a fairly rancorous character, leaves this blistering letter in the Spanish consulate. He was very close with the Spanish regime, basically denouncing his brother, saying that it's because of Jacob that I have been forced to leave the regency. And Jacob then steps into his shoes and assumes power. So, and I like to think of this as Jacob's revenge. So he's a shifty character, and it certainly makes the history a little spicy. But it's a fascinating story of how the family and the business ultimately collapse, and that's really interesting because when you think of this, five Jewish brothers, what immediately comes to mind, of course, is the Rothschilds. But it makes us ask, well, you know, maybe the Rothschilds are the rare exception. Maybe there were lots of Bakris.
And it's just such a strange. I'm just imagining someone going to the U.S. consulate or the British consulate here in Hong Kong and being like, "My business partner's really screwed me, and here's a letter declaring it."
Yeah.
And I guess today the U.S. consulate would be like, "What am I supposed to, like? Okay, am I supposed to do with this?"
Yes. No. Absolutely. And it's interesting because the Spaniards also owed money to the Bakris, and Joseph goes to Livorno to the other brother Salomon in Livorno, and they immediately petition the Spanish government for what's owed to them. But Jacob's doing the same thing. So they're competing for these funds. It's a different world. And the Bakris occupied this kind of liminal middle position in Algerian society, but had close relationships with consuls. And I think this was a question of trust, that Joseph felt that he could trust the Spanish authorities because he had lent them so many funds, and so therefore they had developed this close working relationship, to leave a letter where actually he couldn't trust the Algerian authorities anymore because Jacob had got them on the side. So the family drama plays out across Mediterranean diplomacy in that way.
So what's the United States doing in all of this? Particularly as Britain and France are engaging, you know, in their own conflicts and their own debates over Algiers. You know, I feel like the Barbary Wars are kind of this event in U.S. history that's probably faded from, well, if they were ever part of popular memory, apart from, I guess, the one mention in the Marines hymn where they talk about going to the shores of Tripoli.
Yes.
But I guess, what's the U.S. doing in all of this?
Oh, they were absolutely there. You know, the U.S. were out and about in the world trying to establish themselves, this very new nation, as a power, and particularly wanting to trade with the Mediterranean. You know, the U.S. had these kind of apparently endless resources to trade, and so wood and all sorts of fish, and they want to find trading partners. So they're not looking to exert influence in the same way that Britain and France are, but they do want to establish relationships. But they're also, you know, the shores of Tripoli, it was 1805. They attack Tripoli because of the corsairing, which keeps interrupting, you know, stealing their ships. They also want to show themselves as a power. In 1816, you know, Stephen Decatur, the hero of Tripoli, also attacks Algiers, again, to stop the corsairing. So they're absolutely there. And there's this slow trickle of history writing now that really is beginning to understand this and to place them there and relate that to the early US and how the US is trying to establish itself in the world as a power. But what's so interesting about them is because they're not kind of tied up in this diplomatic spat, because they don't have a dog in that fight, the consuls are really interesting because they have this kind of external perspective. You know, here go the Bakris. They're not interested in the Franco-British contest, but they understand what's going on and they can play these guys off against each other when it suits them. So you get this kind of fascinating commentary that sheds light on what's going on.
What ultimately happens after the French invade? Well, first of all, I think what sparks France to, I guess, finally say enough is enough, we're going to, and then just invade Algiers. And then what happens to these two families after the French take over?
Yes. So France didn't invade Algiers thinking it was ultimately going to colonize. The colonization ends up being a process that takes about a decade. Basically what happens is that so the revolution is overthrown, Napoleon is beaten, the younger brother of Louis XVI, who was beheaded in 1793, is brought back on the throne, so that's Louis XVIII. He's then replaced by his deeply Catholic and highly conservative brother Charles X, extremely unpopular. This is an extremely unpopular regime, and the French, they've got a taste of revolution. So that, you know, there's a kind of things are bubbling by about 1827, and there are poor harvests again. So the ruling regime of Charles X is looking for something to galvanize the people, right? And there's a diplomatic spat in Algiers. So 1819, the French regime finally pays back that debt. They pay the money to Jacob, who makes off with it. But remember that the Bakris had cut the Dey in as their business partner. So the Dey is sitting in Algiers thinking, well, the money should come to him and he will dole it out, but some of it is rightfully his. And writing to that effect to the French regime, constant letters, why haven't you corresponded with me about this? Where is this money? He doesn't know it's been paid back. And the French regime is stonewalling. They refuse to respond. So by 1827, the Dey, that's Hussein, is just beside himself, furious. So the French consul, a fellow called Pierre Duval, goes to visit him because it's Eid, the end of Ramadan. And again, Hussein says, okay, so where is the money? And Duval stonewalls, as he's been instructed to do. And the Dey gets so fed up and so furious about this that he grabs the fan that's being waved about to keep the flies off him and whacks the consul around the face three times. So for the regime back in France, this is a fantastic kind of look over there type distraction. And they create a diplomatic spat, and this escalates until they invade to basically the, because it's this, you know, that it's got to that point basically of escalation, demands, refusals, that kind of thing. So 1830, they invade Algiers, and pretty quickly what happens is that old regime of power relations where Jews could occupy these middle spaces and have direct access to power is gone. And what's put in its place is a European-style state which has a very different idea of relations of power. It has an idea not of informal relations of power but of very much formalised relations of power. And the Bakris are kind of sidelined. So what we find in the decades following the invasion and the colonisation of Algiers is that we still find Bakris. They're working as interpreters. So they're still being middlemen in a way, but they no longer have access to extraordinary power.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, you know, I uncovered the fact that in the early 20th century, there are Bakris in Paris who are antique dealers, and their name is attached to an extremely valuable Ottoman rug, the Bakri sickle leaf carpet that eventually finds its way to the US. So middlemen in all sorts of ways and in some way doing things in an echo of what they did before, but never again with those kind of that kind of direct access to power.
You know, I had a thought as I was reading this book in terms of kind of we can say contemporary parallels. I mean, obviously the idea of debt diplomacy has kind of arisen in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
In terms of how
diplomacy. Yes.
Well, hostage diplomacy, but also just things like, you know, like sovereign debt. And then debates over sovereign debt and what to do about it, and you know, countries maybe leaning on debtor countries to pay back sovereign debts, and then like banks get involved and bondholders get involved. It's obviously a lot more complicated now, and the roles have seemed to have reversed, where now it's unlike I guess in this period of time, where the debtor countries tend to be, I guess, more powerful than the lenders, at least in this particular case. Now, of course, it's the lenders who are far more powerful than the debtors. But I guess, you know, what do we learn about this idea of debt diplomacy by looking at this particular story of the Bakri and the Buznaks, and I guess the debt diplomacy of today?
Yes, what an interesting question. Well, I think, you know, things are perhaps older than we assume they might be. But it tells us also, I think, about the changing nature of structures of power in the world, as you've said. So that we've always had debt diplomacy, But it's interesting to ask then, and historians do, what's the constant and what's the change? And the change is that we don't really have any more those kinds of regimes which were about, which allowed for those kinds of informal relations of power or access to power. The world has shifted in that way, and it's shifted because of what was going on at that particular time, which is the birth of nationalism. So when the world kind of shifts from a model of empires and duchies and kingdoms to nations, is when you see those structures really change. And you know, that's, for me, that's why I'm a historian of the 19th century. It's so fascinating because so much of what shapes the world today, we find its origins and its explanations in these times.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Julie Kalman, author of The Kings of Algiers, How Two Jewish Families Shaped the Mediterranean World During the Napoleonic Wars and Beyond. Julie, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And not just this book, but all of your work. And second, what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
All right. So, well, thank you for that question. And I think if you just put me into Google, you'll find access to my Monash University staff page, or Google itself tells you, I think, a fair bit about me, or Google Scholar. Also, so everything I've published is you know, open in that way. The book is published by Princeton UP University Press, and I know is available now quite widely in the Northern Hemisphere. It's making its way by boat to the Southern Hemisphere, and hopefully it will be here soon, of course, because I'm coming to you from Australia. My next project actually is something quite different, and this is something that's really fascinated me for a very long time. I'm Australian but of European background, and my mother was actually born in Belgium, and I grew up, therefore, reading Tintin and Asterix. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with those sets of comic books.
Oh, I am very familiar with Tintin.
Right. So, yeah, and both of which were really extremely successful around the world. Asterix in particular is the most successful publishing story in French history. So by the early 2000s, they had sold 320 million books. You know, these are figures that a humble academic like me can only dream of. But it begs a question, you know, why so successful? And so I've actually already started on this project, and this book is going to be about how this Asterix series so resonates with French people in the aftermath of the Second World War that it becomes the national myth. So really what interests me as a historian is histories of nation creation and of nation building and of national stories. And so this, in a way, has led me from the Kings of Algiers now to Asterix.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Nu Sarawiwa, author of Black Ghosts, A Journey into the Lives of Africans in China. But before then, Julie, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.